Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Charles Manson become one of the most notorious criminals of the 20th century, and what insidious talents allowed him to attract followers willing to carry out unspeakable violence against innocent victims? Although Manson is, in fact, still alive today, most recently denied parole last year at the age of 77, his name inevitably brings to mind the turbulence of the late 1960s and the early 70s when he was brought to justice as the mastermind of two shockingly gruesome California massacres. My guest today wanted to understand not just the man himself, but the era in which he came of age and the effects of his crime on American culture. Jeff Gwynn is author of the new book Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, and it's worth noting that he is also a proud resident of Fort Worth. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris.
What made you want to really dig into Manson's story and then frame it in its historical context?
Well, with all my nonfiction books, I like to pick an era in American history to write about and then find some iconic individual or event that will maybe pull readers in. The thing I'm always curious about is this. No event, particularly no important event, occurs in a vacuum. Things lead up to it. In the case of the Tate LaBianca murders and Charles Manson, it's 44 years later. We still remember the Manson's still a household word. So I really wanted to ferret out two things. First of all, if Charles Manson was such a monster, as he certainly appeared to be, how did we grow him? What happened to create this person step by step by step? And the second thing was, why do we still remember him in a time when we can't even mostly remember the names of the teenagers who did the Columbine shootings? There have been so many massacres, so many atrocities in America in all these years since. What is it about Manson that makes him continue to resonate? So those were the things I wanted to dig into, and it's been almost 3 years since I started.
You know, I was thinking a lot about this, reading this book, because you and I talked after your last book that explored the story of Bonnie and Clyde. And it's interesting because although they did some very bad things, given the passage of time, somehow we find this exhilarating romance to their final crime spree. Manson's story, on the other hand, has never lost its ability to unsettle us.
One of the reasons that's true is we've accepted Charles Manson's word for too much, everything from his background to the reason he did things. If this book does anything, I hope in a sense it demystifies Charles Manson so we can finally get him into perspective. Until we understand who a person really was, the things that really happened in his life as opposed to the things he tells us happened, we're never going to be able to get past what you very correctly call an unsettling feeling. Charles Manson is a human being. He's not a mystic with magical powers. And his real life story is far more fascinating than the mythology, not just for what it tells us about Charles Manson, but what it tells us about the way our culture and country have moved since the 1930s when he was born.
So it's worth noting here that plenty of people have had equally challenging childhoods and grown up to be perfectly decent people, but it does seem that Manson's life got off to an inauspicious start. Tell us a little bit about his mother.
Well, to hear Charles Manson tell it, and tell it he has, he was the illegitimate child of a teenage prostitute who once tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer and threw him into god-awful juvenile detention homes, starting when he was 10, because she didn't love him and want him around her. In fact, Charles Manson's mother, Kathleen, was a high-spirited girl who was raised by her mother in a very strict, fundamentalist Christian household. Kathleen, like a lot of teenage girls, 15 years old, wanted to dance. She wanted to dress up and go out on the weekends. Her mother forbade it. Kathleen did it anyway, hooked up with a bad crowd, and ultimately became pregnant by a much older man named Colonel Scott. While Manson insists his was an illegitimate birth, Kathleen married another man, William Manson, almost 5 months before Charlie was born. There was no hint of illegitimacy. There's no proof anywhere that Kathleen was ever a prostitute. She did go to prison for about 3.5 years for one of the most foolishly botched armed robberies in the history of crime. She wasn't very good at it. While she was in prison, Charles lived with and was cared for wonderfully well by his grandmother and then his aunt and uncle. He lived with them and his cousin Joanne. When his mother got out of prison, she took Charlie to live with her. And he was an absolutely incorrigible child. The things he's famous for in 1969 that we remember today, he was doing in elementary school. Would it be okay to give an example?
Absolutely.
I found relatives and friends of Manson's who'd never talked before, and I was told this story by his cousin Joanne. And Manson was living with Joanne and her parents in McMeekin, West Virginia at the time. While Manson is still in first grade, he recruits some girls in his class to beat up a boy he doesn't like. When the school principal comes looking for Charlie, he tells her it's not his responsibility. The girls were doing what they wanted to do, so don't say he's to blame. Hmm. The same defense he uses all those years later in Tate LaBianca. What we saw, the things we know, actually go back such a long way, it's staggering.
So, Jeff, it was determined in Manson's adult life, I guess when he was imprisoned one of multiple times, that he had a higher than average IQ, and yet he never really learned to read very well. Did you gain any insight into why that might be?
Sure. We think because someone is uneducated, that means he must be stupid, and that's the furthest thing from the truth. Charles Manson could always learn anything he wanted to if he saw a way for it to be useful to him. And this whole mystic philosophy that he supposedly was spouting, he dragged from a number of different sources. One of the foundations of the things he used, the rap he used to attract young people to him, was something he learned in prison. He was able to get into a Dale Carnegie course. And from the moment he was in that course, he thought he could learn the things in it them to become a successful pimp when he got out of prison. That was Charlie's professional ambition at the time. He didn't always want to be a rock and roll star. And I found cellmates of his who talked about how Manson would take the How to Win Friends and Influence People textbook to his cell and pore over it, just fascinated by it. So he obviously can read, even if that may take a great deal of concentration on his part. When I later met Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, in prison, said to them, what are some of the things Charles Manson said to you to get you to initially follow him? They said, he said this, he said this, he said this, almost word for word out of chapter 7 in How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Hmm. You call him a sociopath?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. He's not a lunatic. He's not crazy in any sense. He is a cunning, intelligent sociopath.
And so the this is like the worst advertisement ever for Dale Carnegie courses.
I do feel badly about that, but it's the truth.
Yeah, but I mean, it is interesting because it's almost like there doesn't have to be any genuine sentiment behind these things. And Manson obviously realized that to still be able to use these techniques.
Well, think about the other things that Charles Manson wove into all this. Besides Dale Carnegie, he used religion, the Bible.
Scientology.
The music of the Beatles, Scientology. He turned things that were meant for positive purpose into something evil. He always did that. One person who's known him well described him to me as a cancer cell, only interested in whatever is good for him, helps him grow and become more powerful. And if anything else has to be destroyed, well, that's too bad.
So he started doing time when he was a young teenager in reform school. Talk about his experiences there.
The way Manson has told it, right away at age 10, he was thrown into sort of these draconian reform schools where horrible things were done to him. And it is true, the American juvenile justice system of that time was a pretty awful thing. But when he's initially placed in some boys' homes, they're places where parents put their children who absolutely can't behave, who have violent tendencies. Kathleen Manson, trying to raise her son right, finds that he's incorrigible in terms of skipping school. He'll never go to school. He shoplifts. He steals. He has violent tendencies. And her hope was, after she consulted with her own mother, with other members of her immediate family, with school authorities, that it would be best for her son if he went somewhere where there were some strict rules and regulations to follow. And these are the first places that Charles Manson went. When he ended up in some of the rougher places, it was his own doing. I mean, at 13 years old, he's committing armed robberies, stealing cars. And once he's in these harsher facilities, yes, to a certain extent, he suffers. He was small physically. There were brutal things happening. But it's also true that by the time Manson was out of these places, he'd become a predator himself rather than a victim. He always learned how to gain control for himself, and that was a lifelong trait.
You include a number of little-known photos of Manson in the book, some of which I think have not been published before, including
right.
this one picture that I couldn't take my eyes off of because it's so astonishingly normal-looking. It's his wedding picture from the mid-50s.
Right. I was able to find Manson's sister Nancy and cousin Joanne, who have spent all these years trying not to be found because of the stigma of being associated with Charles Manson. Once they agreed to talk to me, they had astonishing stories to tell, and to back them up, they would pull out photo albums and actually hand me the photos and say I could use them in the book. So some of these photos have never been seen before outside of some Manson family members. And when I say Manson family, I'm talking blood relatives and not the acolytes he acquired later. When Manson got out of reform school for the last time, 19 years old, he comes back to live with his grandmother in McMeekin, West Virginia, where she pretty much forces him into the mainstream. She was a very strict Nazarene church member. And part of her deal with him, if he lived with her, he had to go to not only Nazarene church, but Sunday school. He had to try to find a job. At first, Manson doesn't get along well with the other kids. When he tries to tell the Nazarene youth group that he's cool because he's been shooting up, they think maybe he's talking about a basketball or possibly road signs, but it doesn't sound good, whatever it is, so they start shunning him. But then he meets one of the prettiest girls in this little factory town, Rosalie Willis, and he's 20. She's 16. They get married, and for a very short while, all the people back in McMeekin who remember Charles Manson and have never talked about him before, who loathe him and hate everything he did before and after, they all agree there's about a 6 to 8 month period when Charles Manson tries to live straight. Unfortunately, it wasn't successful.
Why do you think he was able to do it for that long? Or was the motivation simply that he wanted to please his grandmother? Could that have been possible?
Well, the minute he didn't have to live with his grandmother anymore, when he had a job and a wife, he really wasn't that interested in pleasing her. Hmm. What I think happened, he's married. And by the way, the picture in the book, Manson always says none of his family wanted anything to do with him, none of his real family. That's a reception in his grandmother's home. She threw a wonderful reception for the young couple. Everybody in the Nazarene church came. They all brought lots of gifts, which Charlie later tried to hawk. And he goes to work in some different jobs, but he has trouble holding a job simply because he won't take orders. He always likes to talk back. Money runs short. And he goes from an existence where in the evenings he likes to sit out in the porch stoop with his wife and call to friends, starts stealing cars, and that's the end of it.
My guest is author Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Jeff Gwynn, who joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. He's got a new book out called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jeff, what did you learn about the origins of Manson's obsession with a sort of apocalyptic race war that he not only expected to come, but frankly wanted to come?
I was able to talk to old prison cellmates of Manson and some of the people he grew up with. His roots, we have to remember, were in rural West Virginia. He grew up not associating with black people. In fact, he certainly had barely seen a black person until he goes to prison, where he's notable because in prisons, in American prisons in the 1950s, the races usually didn't mingle, but Manson is so prejudiced he won't even talk to a black or Hispanic inmate. He'll only talk to white inmates. But the black Muslims who were in prison, who were very organized, who had a reputation for toughness, both impressed and frightened him. And he began to talk, even in the 1950s, about how if the blacks ever rose up against the whites, if they were properly armed, even though he believed that blacks were intellectually and socially inferior, he thought they might very well overcome the white race. When he gets out of prison for the first time in a long time, and particularly when he finds himself in Berkeley for a little while, in Haight-Ashbury, this is the same time in American culture that there's the emergence of the Black Panthers, young black men who are making it very clear they're not going to be pushed around, and if they are pushed, they'll push back. Many of them openly carry weapons, which under California law is legal. Manson immediately begins to imagine that this is the forerunner of a race war. And it's a time in America where there begin to a series begins of racial riots throughout all the major cities. And so there's an atmosphere where a lot of people believe that it is possible blacks and whites are never going to be able to get along in America. Manson isn't creating something new, but he's certainly being able to buy into, tap into what is happening in American culture. And of course, when he ends up in Los Angeles, this is pretty shortly after the Watts riot, it's maybe the most racially tense major city in America. Manson, who's trying to find ways to make these young people follow him, starts telling him that there's going to be an apocalyptic race war called Helter Skelter, a name he got from the Beatles, a song that the Beatles did. He tells them that the blacks are going to annihilate the whites, and then the blacks will take over the country, but they won't have the intellectual ability to govern. Manson and the people who stay loyal to him will hide in a pit in the Mojave Desert that Manson knows how to find. When the race war is over, they will emerge. And because the blacks will need help finding what to do, Manson and his followers will rule the country. He also warned them that if they weren't loyal to him, if they didn't come out into the desert, if they stayed behind in Los Angeles, then when the war was over, they would either have been killed by black people or enslaved by them. So their choice was life or death. But if you wanted life, you had to stay with Manson. And the proposed Helter Skelter was the reason.
It was before he arrived in Berkeley, but when he was in prison, that he took up the guitar. Was he any good?
Well, Manson was always musical, even as a child. His cousin Joanne says that he could play piano by ear and sang very well in church on Sundays. They had to drag him to get him there, but he liked to sing. He began playing guitar when he was back in McMeekin as a young married man. At the time, he was listening to country music and wanted to kind of be a country singer. It was just one of the things he thought about. But when he's in prison for the last time, he first hears the music of the Beatles. Not only is he transfixed by the music, but he loves the adoration that the Beatles get, the power that they've got. And he starts telling all the inmates in prison that he's going to be bigger than they are. That's when he starts writing his own songs. The Beatles did it, so Manson had to do it, and performing them. He certainly considered himself a great, gifted musician. That was not the opinion of the Los Angeles professionals who ultimately had to judge whether to give him a record deal or not.
But again, you know, going back to the historical context, he was, you know, he came of age in an era where for a young man, musical talent was sort of a ticket to superstardom, or could be.
Well, Manson was one of hundreds of thousands of young men and women who each believed that he or she had the ultimate talent and would be the next big star. One of the things that frustrated Charles Manson most was he came so close to getting what he wanted. When he gets out of prison, and of course there's the time that he's in Haight-Ashbury, he's recruiting his followers, but it's always his intention that at a certain time he's going to go down to Los Angeles, perform his songs for somebody important, get a record deal, and become a superstar. He doesn't tell the people in the family about this. The way he explains it is they have this great philosophy. Charles is going to put it into his music, and then the music will be save the whole rest of the world if only they're listen to it. So the followers don't realize Manson wants this for himself, not for the salvation of civilization. Please, go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way he chose his, I suppose I don't want to use the word victims, recruits for the family. What the qualities that he was looking for, the assets that he was looking for?
He talked openly about this, that he first wanted to start with young women. He wanted to find ones who were bent but not broken. If they were completely helpless, they were useless to him. He wanted to find women, and I think I'm old enough I can say girls, who had problems at home, had drifted away from their blood relations, were in and around the San Francisco area around the Summer of Love. He recruited them by telling them things from Dale Carnegie and by explaining, you're unhappy because your real-life families wouldn't accept you for who you are. Join us. We will love you for who you are. And then he explained to the women that their role was to help him attract men to the group, using sex or whatever other things they could bring to bear. He got his first few recruits. His first one was actually in Berkeley, right outside of prison. Then he added Lynette Fromm, who would be known as Squeaky Patricia Krenwinkel. And from there, he would continue to recruit and weed out the people that would come to him. Some didn't obey his orders. He'd get rid of them. Others he only wanted because they had some money or a credit card or a pink slip to a car. When he had that, he'd get rid of them. So he would have a core group and an evolving outer circle of other people who might or might not stay, depending on whether they pleased Manson.
What was life like for those on the inner circle who ultimately would travel with him from northern to southern California and take up residence wherever he was?
Well, that was one of the important things I think we've been able to establish in this book, particularly with Patricia Krenwinkel, who was one of Manson's first three followers and who had never given a full interview about any of this in all the years. And Pat talked about how Manson originally attracted her by telling her she was so ugly that no one would love her but him. And she had been estranged from her parents. She was living with a sister who was having some personal problems. She thought if she went with Manson, he'd be her boyfriend, but in fact found he already had two other women she had to share him with. Manson took this young woman who was not attractive, had no social skills.
She was like a nerdy librarian, is that right?
No, the nerdy librarian, Mary Bruner, was his first
one.
That's okay. It's hard. It runs
the family
together
blends
in everybody's
together.
Mind. Well, of course they do. And that was part of what Manson tried to do, to tell them that we're all one. So that's exactly it. But he would make Krenwinkel stand in front of trees and throw knives over her head like a circus act, telling her if she ducked, it would prove that she didn't trust him enough. He would make everybody get in a school bus, travel around the country, trying very hard to isolate them from other people who might have some influence over them so they could only hear from Manson. A lot of drugs were in use. Women were not allowed to have any money at all, so if they wanted to get away from Manson, they couldn't afford a phone call, let alone a bus ticket. He used the classic tricks of a pimp, along with some of the Dale Carnegie technique, along with drugs, sex, whatever else he had to use. And sometimes it was physical violence, that if the women wouldn't obey him, he'd beat them.
So, you know, what you've described, he just sounds like an awful person that anyone in their right mind would stay clear of. But he managed, after he moved to Southern California, to make some powerful, I don't know if friends is the right word, but acquaintances.
It was a time when the rich music celebrities wanted to sort of at least pretend sometimes to be egalitarian, and Manson was an interesting guy. He hooked up with Dennis Wilson because Charlie brought along, you know, a dozen willing women who would do whatever Dennis wanted. Wilson had been physically abused by his father as a boy, so he buys into Manson's rap about your blood family doesn't care about you, they mistreat you. And Wilson tried to help Charlie get a record deal. The fact that Charlie was only modestly talented was a real problem, and that's when Manson realized that maybe if a rock star can't get him a record deal, he needs to move on to somebody even more powerful in the music industry. And that was Dennis Wilson's close friend, record producer Terry Melcher. Hmm. Manson goes on to Melcher, tries to offer his music to Melcher. Melcher listens and just decides there's nothing there, turns Manson down. That was one of the threads, though only one, that led to the Tate LaBianca murders. Manson had failed in front of his followers, and to keep them, he needed to do something even more spectacular.
So Melcher had moved houses. Ultimately, am I right about this? Dennis Wilson essentially had to move out of his house to get away from Charles Manson. Move out of his own home.
Right. Manson and the family moved in, and they chose not to move out. Wilson, after a few months, began to realize there was more to Manson than just an interesting rap and mediocre music. Manson was demanding that Wilson join the family. He threatened him at least one time with a knife. He threatened some of Wilson's friends. And so Wilson, who by this time was kind of scared of Manson, a few days before his lease was up at the fancy mansion on Sunset Boulevard, moved to another smaller place on the beach and didn't tell Manson where he'd gone. And then the landlords threw Manson and the family out of the mansion. That's when they moved full-time to Spahn Ranch.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I am schooled here by Jerome, who writes, nerdy librarian, and forgive me for that, Jerome. I'm not implying that librarians are nerdy, and if they are, I am nerdy too. So we will take that. So it's a little bit confusing for people who don't remember the exact situation. But, okay, so Terry Melcher is living with Candace Bergen. They are together. He has sort of humiliated Manson by not showing up to on the day that Manson thought this was going to be his sort of break to stardom and he would get a record contract and all that. So talk about where Melcher was living and how that sort of led to what ultimately happened with Sharon Tate and her friends.
Terry Melcher didn't want anything further to do with Charles Manson. He was living at Cielo Drive, a beautiful hilltop house in Los Angeles. But he moved with Candace Bergen to a beach house owned by his mother, didn't tell Manson he was going. At one point, Manson actually showed up at Cielo then looking for Terry Melcher and was told that he no longer lived there. And it was at this time momentarily that Manson came face to face with Sharon Tate, the actress who had moved into Cielo with her husband Roman Polanski after Melcher left. Melcher did finally audition Manson, by the way, at Spahn Ranch. Charlie orchestrated everything, played all his tunes for Melcher, and Melcher was unimpressed, and Manson did not get that recording contract. When the time came a few months later that Manson thought it was time to precipitate Helter Skelter, the reason he picked Cielo Drive was not because he was sure that Terry Melcher still lived there. He knew he didn't. But he figured anybody living in that house had to be rich and be celebrities, and their deaths would cause the kind of public notice that Manson wanted.
And Manson's plan was to make it appear that the Black Panthers had been responsible.
Right. There's two other threads working in this. Manson had been part of a murder involving a drug deal. Gary Hinman had died. Bobby Beausoleil, a friend of the family in Manson, had committed the murder at Manson's direction. They tried to make it look like Black Panthers had done it, but Beausoleil was arrested. Manson was worried that Beausoleil might somehow implicate him in the murders. They decided they'd have copycat murders so that Beausoleil then would be released by police. They had to have murders that would appear to be precipitated by the Panthers or Black militants. And at the same time, Manson had been preaching to his followers all about Helter Skelter. I don't think he ever believed that if the police even bought into the militants committing the Tate murders, that there would be an entire race war. But he certainly hoped that there might be another race riot in Los Angeles. That's something he can point to his followers and say, see, the thing is starting. You have to stay with me. You have to be loyal to me. So all that factored in.
So we have an email here from Gary in Denton. It's a perfect time to ask this question. What's up with UNT, then NTSU alum Tex Watson these days, and how did he get caught up in Charlie's web?
Charlie met Tex Watson when Watson gave Dennis Wilson a lift home. Watson had come to California, fallen in love with drugs and casual sex. Charlie had these things to offer him. And for Manson, Watson was an ace mechanic, and so he could be useful that way. Ultimately, Manson did lead the two nights of murder for Tate LaBianca. Watson's currently in a California prison. He has converted to Christianity. He doesn't talk about Manson anymore. His prison ministry is called Abounding Love Ministries. And the skeptics say the acronym is ALMS, meaning it's Alms for Tex and All in Act. I don't know because he wouldn't talk to me. He doesn't talk about Manson anymore.
My guest is author Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jeff Gwynn. He joins us today from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. His new book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Jeff, there's a great deal of detail in the book about the Tate murders and then the LaBianca murders the next night. I will leave it to people to read the book to get that very gory detail. But I want to ask you this, because some of these events, some of these specific actions remain in dispute even now, these 44 years later, 43 and a half years later. Can you talk about how you made decisions about sort of whom to believe and which accounts to take seriously in exactly what took place?
Well, the whole process is going through what people have said. It's important to remember that when you're involved in traumatic events, individuals can remember it differently. And even though it seems like somebody must be lying, each thinks he or she's telling the truth. Vincent Bugliosi, who wrote Helter Skelter, was extremely cooperative with me on this project. I can't thank him enough. And not only was he willing to talk quite a bit about the evidence that was obtained at the time, but I talked to some of the officers who were involved, not just in the actual investigation, but the administration of the LAPD at the time. The most striking, though, the best new information came from Patricia Krenwinkle. Krenwinkle was the Manson family member. She was there both nights for both sets of murders. And she had never talked in detail about any of this before, even to the police. She had told me she would answer all my questions honestly and objectively, and she did. And so for the first time, we have some solid information about some things that have bothered people for 44 years. The first question being, did or did not Manson go back to the Tate murder site after the killings and rearrange things for greater effect? And second, why on the night of the Tate murders was one person at the Cielo property spared? These things had bewildered the police all these years since, and Krenwinkel, talking for the first time, answers them. Those answers are these. Yes, after the murders, when Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian drove back to Spahn Ranch, Manson was there waiting for them and interrogated them. How had they left the scene? How had they made it look? He was unhappy. He didn't think it was spectacular enough. So he jumped in the same car they'd driven back in and drove to Cielo himself, where he rearranged furniture. And the most striking thing he did, there was a large American flag in one corner of the house. He took that flag and draped it over the couch, which was right by Sharon Tate's body. He thought that would really be dramatic. Krenwinkel and the others only found out what he'd done during the trial when crime scene photos were exhibited in court. And they saw that things were different than they had been when they had left. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's all right. Please continue.
William Gerritsen, the young caretaker in the guest house on the property, was arrested the day after the murders as the most likely suspect because it seemed obvious people came onto the property to kill everybody, and yet he's spared. Why? That must have meant he did it. In fact, according to Patricia Krenwinkel, and this was horrific, it was hard for her to talk about and I think even harder to listen to. Krenwinkel had chased Abigail Folger out into the lawn and had stabbed her a number of times while Tex Watson had pursued Wojciech Frykowski nearby on the lawn and was stabbing him. Krenwinkel didn't know if Folger was dead or not. She called over to Watson for help. Watson told her he had finished Folger off and that Krenwinkel should go kill whoever in the little house in the back. Krenwinkel walked around a pathway just out of sight of Watson, had a dizzy spell, leaned up against the wall. She waited a few minutes, went back to Watson and said she'd looked in the window of the guest house, no one was there. And Watson said, okay, that's why William Gerritsen lived, because Patricia Krenwinkel had a dizzy spell.
Why do you think people were willing to talk to you, some people, after all this time? There's not much to be gained at this point. Can you talk about what proposals you made to the people who ultimately were willing to speak to you, members of Manson's biological family, Krenwinkel and others who were associates of his?
Well, starting with Manson's family and the people who knew him growing up, it was much easier for everybody to accept Manson's wild tales about his childhood. In some of the documentation that I did, it actually wasn't that hard. It involves going to courthouses and looking up marriage licenses and birth certificates and so forth. That could have pretty much, I think, been done by anybody. For his sister and his cousin, when I started the project, I had no idea they existed. I don't think anybody really did. But in talking to people in McMeekin, they started to mention the fact that, hey, wait a minute, have you... We don't know where Joanne is anymore, but if you could find his cousin, she could probably talk to you. Then I heard a rumor of his sister. It took a long time to track them. I didn't want to knock on their doors and say, hi, this is what you've been dreading for 45 years. Tell me everything. I mean, they've got the right to their privacy if they want it. Mm-hmm. I sent them registered letters telling them who I was, that I wanted to write a book that was true and not mythology. I asked if I could send them copies of some of my previous books so they could see what kind of writer I was. And I also told them if they didn't want to cooperate, I promised not to give their contact information to anybody. I sent the books. We talked on the phone a few times. Neither one of them knew the other, and they lived far, far apart on this continent. They each finally invited me just to fly out to talk, just to see what might be done. I went to see each of them. They ultimately agreed to cooperate. They were very helpful. Back in West Virginia, back with some of Manson's cellmates over the years, they'd gotten tired of all the lies that he'd been telling, but no one had ever actually said, well, if that's not true, what is true? And how can you prove to me that it is? once they got started, they had many stories. As for Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten had given some interviews before, and I talked to Leslie first. After I'd had my third visit with Leslie, I told her that I wanted her to be aware I was going to try to contact Patricia and see if Patricia would talk. Leslie said I didn't have to worry about that. She'd already talked to Pat, had said Pat should talk to me. Pat was not only willing to do it, they were already filling out my visitor's papers to see her. So I guess in a sense I have to say thank you to Leslie Van Houten for the fact that Patricia Krenwinkel chose this book for her first full form of what she remembers.
Your sense is that both of them are deeply contrite for their role in all of this?
Very much so. They also have a great sense not only of remorse but of their own guilt for the things that they did. I do not believe if they were ever paroled they would present a danger to society, but I don't think they'll ever be paroled. The Manson stigma is too much. Manson, on the other hand, I think if you let him out tomorrow, a 78-year-old man, somehow, some way, he would cobble together a following and they would do awful things. That's been his pattern from early childhood. It's not going to change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. A question. What do we know about Manson's biological and his adoptive fathers?
We know quite a bit about Colonel Scott, who, by the way, his biological father, who was not a military man. He was a low-level thug, mostly, in the Ashland, Kentucky area where Manson's mother, Kathleen, first met him, worked in some factories, and while he was convincing Kathleen that he was a single military man who thought at 15 she was the most wonderful woman he'd ever seen, he also had a wife and a couple kids who he ultimately went back to. After Manson was born, she sued him for child support and got an initial payment of $25, and then it was supposed to be a few dollars a month. He never paid that. William Manson, who married Kathleen before Manson was born, is more of a puzzle. We know that he was a very small man who had worked in a laundromat. We don't know exactly where he met her. We do know that when he divorced her about a year and a half after their marriage, he claimed that she had broken the marriage by being unfaithful, and he had no more to do with her or Charles ever since. He was involved in World War II. As a coastal watcher out in California, and he's buried out in the California Military Cemetery.
In hindsight, Jeff, it seems apparent to everyone that the Tate and the LaBianca murders were related. Why was that not so obvious to investigators at the time?
It was a violent time in Los Angeles. There were about 90 murders that were being investigated at the same time, and the feeling was, after the Tate butchery, that some sick copycat killers had decided to go out and do some murders of their own. The two investigating groups, the Tate group of detectives, was older, more traditional. LaBianca were younger guys who liked to think outside the box. I've talked to their superior officers, and the fact was, frankly, they just didn't get along very well. Right after the LaBianca murders were committed, the detectives from another county who were investigating the Gary Hinman murder tried to get in touch and say, hey, we think those two things you're investigating have something in common with our case. And no one listened to them. It took months and months until finally, more through luck than anything else, the LaBianca investigators were able to find some things after Manson's arrest for something entirely unrelated, the Mojave Desert. That's when they started putting two and two together, but it was a confusing time. There were all kinds of cases being investigated, and that's why it took a while.
You know, if you think about the timing of this and the trials through the early 70s and people's kind of obsession with this horrifying story, and then you think of the rise of, say, the horror film genre, they seem really close. Is it too much of a leap to say that this case got Americans really exploring their darkest fears on film?
Well, the film was all, there have always been horror films. What Manson did was provide a new generation of it. It's wrong to say that Charles Manson is insane. He never was. He is a very cold, calculating sociopath, and he used to brag that he was a man of 1,000 hats. He could change his personality to fit any situation he found himself in. And because of that, Manson, after his arrest, knew how to use that public forum to seem horrific, to seem like one of the scariest, most crazy persons anyone had ever seen. And a lot of America bought into that. There was also a small minority who thought he was cool and a real rebel. He has active followers again today. Charles Manson stage managed almost all of this. Just before his final arrest, he gathered the family members around him. And he said, if I'm ever arrested, I'm going to play Crazy Charlie. I'm going to act crazy until I convince the people I'm insane and they let me go. And everyone from Krenwinkel to Van Houten to the people who've known him growing up, the ones who really know him remain convinced to this day that after all these years, it's still an act. He's playing Crazy Charlie and he's being very effective doing it.
Were you disappointed not to have the opportunity to speak with him for this book?
Well, he wrote to me. It was a pretty interesting and nasty letter, and he later gave me permission to use some of his artwork in the book. If Manson didn't want me to write the book, he knew some of the people I was talking to and knew I was going to be proving that a lot of what he said were lies. But on the other hand, he's so fascinated by any kind of exposure, any kind of attention, he couldn't resist at least working with me a little. If I'd sat down in a room with him, he would have put on the Crazy Charlie act, the same as he's done all these years. I think the only useful information I would have been able to provide readers is what he looks like now. But we have his most recent picture from the California penal system, so they know even that.
What kind of life does he have in prison?
Pretty good one. He likes his hobbies. He's got TV to watch. He likes to play his guitar. And he's still famous. In a very unfortunate way, Charles Manson has gotten exactly what he wanted out of life at the expense of so many others.
He's next eligible for parole in something like 14 years. Is that right?
It doesn't matter. He could be eligible for parole every day of the week. He's never, ever going to get out. And believe me, that's best for all of us.
Did you have nightmares writing this book?
You bet. The worst was the night after Patricia Krenwinkel had described the murders to me in her California prison. I had to go back to my motel, transcribe what she said in my laptop, and then try to turn out the lights and go to sleep. I didn't go to sleep that night.
The new book by author Jeff Gwynn is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff, it's always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for letting me come on the program, and I hope that some of your listeners who read the book will find it worthwhile.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. It's always free there. And of course, we welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.